Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 183, Science Faction, the Jurassic period.
This is where the periods start becoming deadly. Like, if you were to recreate this period in a theme park, shit gets real.
Except, I don't know. So here's my big thing. I know you've probably heard this before from science nerds. Most of the dinosaurs, like T-Rex and stuff, they're Cretaceous dinosaurs. Yeah, they're not
in Jurassic.
Jurassic
Park, they're all Cretaceous.
What? Why? Why did they choose it this way? Like, it doesn't make any sense. You could have just called it Cretaceous Park.
Are all the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park Cretaceous?
No, because they do.
Just
they span.
T-Rex is Cretaceous.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's...
like Triceratops, that's...
They did overlap as well. Like, some of them, like, I don't remember. I think in the books, I don't know if they have it in the movie, they had Stegosaurus, which is, like, super far removed from T-Rex.
That's in the books, but not the movie.
Yeah, Stegosaurus is, like, extinct by the Jurassic. Like, forget the Cretaceous, so.
Oh, and Fantasia, they fight.
Fantasia.
That's right.
The Stegosaurus fights and loses to the T-Rex.
And it's played to gripping orchestral play.
Well, indeed, the Jurassic period spanned 56 million years from the end of the Triassic period, 201 million years ago, to the beginning of that Cretaceous period, 145 million years ago.
So wait, we didn't establish, though, who the apex predator was in this Jurassic period.
I mean, there would probably be a lot of things. I think you would have some of the avian dinosaurs. You'd also have a lot of the large reptiles. So it depends where you're talking about, because you also have sea creatures that are really large at this time. And
Megalodon?
Don't know if Megalodon's around yet. He certainly would be a huge apex predator at this point, but there's also other things like giant sea reptiles, giant sea fish, all that kind of stuff, even dinosaurs that have kind of semi-evolved into aquatic life.
Krakens.
Yes, exactly, of course. All of these things, and then as well as like big things like which would come later in the Cretaceous, things like Allosaurus and T-Rex and all of those things.
What is the thing that like marks the line between the Cretaceous and the Jurassic? Extinction event?
Yes,
there?
good question. So the Jurassic continued the middle period of the Mesozoic era, which is kind of the age of reptiles. That's when we see dinosaurs come about. That's when we see all that
they're
stuff.
They're not reptiles.
Dinosaurs came from reptiles, true, but you're right. They're warm-blooded. They have some other characteristics to them. They're basically avians. They're birds is essentially what they are. The start of the period was marked by the Triassic-Jurassic extinction event, which we mentioned last week, and then two other smaller extinction events occurred during this period. So it's not exactly like the friendliest time to be alive, on top of the fact that there's a bunch of dinosaurs running around that'll probably...
But it's a long period.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. You know, it's 50 million years, I guess. Kind of long. But this would lead us into that famous Cretaceous era, which we'll discuss next week. That is the hallmark of the dinosaurs. That is most of what we think of when we think of dinosaurs. That's big T-Rex running around. And that also leads at the end of that period to the last major extinction event that we all, of course, think about when we think of major extinction events, which would be the Cretaceous extinction. And that is something we will get into next week. And speaking of somebody who is more concerned on whether he could do something than whether he should do something, I am your host, comedian archaeologist Robert Timothy. With me, as always, is my comedian, Mr. Damian Mercado. Damian, how you doing this afternoon?
Doing great. Was doing better until you decided to claim the Jeff Goldblum man for yourself.
Yeah, you always like to think of yourself as a little bit of a Goldblum, huh? But in reality, you're the lawyer who gets eaten on the toilet. And of course, our scientist for the evening, none other than our own Dr. Malcolm, Dr. Seb. Seb, how are you doing this evening?
Good. I'm not a doctor yet.
Yeah, close enough. You're in a PhD program. Yeah. I'll give it to you on that one. And we, of course, are broadcasting this from Madhouse Comedy Club along the skyline of beautiful downtown San Diego. Come on out to Madhouse for their Saturday Night Showcase. And when you're not doing that, check out our website at www.thesciencefaction.com for all the articles we cover here, as well as some we don't get to.
And tweet us at Faction Science if you got anything you want to say, question for Bobby or myself.
And, of course, as we have been telling you for the past few weeks, we had a big flat Earth debate that just took place a few days ago. We will be teasing that with a few clips on this particular episode of that debate a little bit later on and following up later on with the full video on our website. So if you want to make sure you hear that as soon as it comes out, go ahead and subscribe on Science Faction's Facebook page and we will make sure we post as soon as that video comes up on our website. But for now, let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
the science articles are like the vegetables that we have to eat if we want to get
right.
a dessert.
You want to get to that good, gossipy, flat earth debate stuff. You're going to have to learn some motherfucking stuff.
Here's the thing. Like, we already have parents. Do we need another one? Just give us our fucking dessert. We're adults.
Damien, this is how you get to being you in life. You just want to eat your dessert and you never want to get your damn pork chops down.
Just because I'm 400 pounds, that has nothing to do with my eat habits or ability to control myself.
All right, guys. Article number one. I just did an entire debate attempting to unravel a conspiracy theory, and I'm about to argue that scientifically speaking, planes do leave chemtrails, and though they've hurt us quite substantially for a while, they have finally gotten so bad that they're actually hurting the very owners of the planes spewing them out.
Wait, are you fucking with me? You're into the chemtrails thing now? Did the flat earth guy get to you?
He must have convinced me. No, in fact, I do believe that there is something called chemtrails, though it is not what is portrayed by conspiracy theorists. The chemical in this case is a gas form, and we call it carbon dioxide.
Why does it harm the owner specifically?
Actually, great question, Seb. We're going to get to that when we get to this particular science article.
Because most airline CEOs own property along the coastline in Florida, and this is directly hurting them.
That's actually probably true. But no, it is not that. Let's go over this. So you might be wondering, like, what are you talking about? Obviously, we know that engines produce CO2. We know that our cars produce CO2. But what most people don't realize is just how much CO2 is produced by commuter airline traffic. It is insane. It's about 3% of our total CO2 emissions. You might think 3%, that's not that big. That's huge. If you want to think of all the things that we contribute to CO2 emissions, 3% of the total U.S. output of CO2 comes from just you and I getting on a Southwest flight and heading over a few cities.
What percent comes from cars?
And cattle farts.
Well, so to go to Seb's question, this also means it's 9% of our transportation CO2 comes from this as well. Now, cars can be higher, but obviously the one problem with that is whether or not you're looking at the numbers and they go between people using their cars as commuter cars or things like 18-wheeler big-wheel trucks, which actually contribute a whole lot because they're carrying a lot of stuff at the time. So that number fluctuates depending on where you look at it. But also, a lot of times, if you think about it, when you're going in a car, for instance, you're not polluting that much per mile traveled. So if you want to look at your most energy-efficient way to travel, it would be the bus, and you're using a certain amount per bus. Slightly more effective than that is train. You're using a certain amount per train. Train is about double what you use for a car. You put out about twice as much CO2 emissions to drive in a car. But anybody who's quick to thinking will figure out that that means if you're driving with two people in a car, you're exactly as efficient as driving in a train. In fact, just tiny bit more efficient.
When you say in a train, you mean per person?
Yes, exactly. So if you put two people in a given car, and again, that's going to change on your gas mileage and everything, your carbon output is about the same as you would a train, which means that as soon as you put three or more in that car or have a highly effective car in terms of MPGs, you're actually more efficient than a train. So car travel is not as inefficient, especially per miles traveled per individual, as you might think.
But that's because our trains aren't electric.
Some of them are.
But when you're saying that, you mean non-electric trains.
No, because you still have to produce the electricity for that.
So even then?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
How much would a car have to roll coal in order to negate the...
That rolling coal is, of course, where there's modifications people do to diesel engines where they just dump unburned fuel in so it shoots out a bunch of black smoke so that they can literally drown Priuses in clouds of black smoke as a form of political protest.
Because fuck liberals and yes. their education.
And it gets even better because it also means that not only is plane flight the least efficient form of transport per mile traveled, but the CO2 emissions is only one part of it. The actual trails we see, you'll hear people like me say all the time, those aren't random chemicals going in the air. They're not spraying chemicals, you idiots.
Well, they are chemicals.
They're it's water vapor, basically.
That's a chemical.
Yeah.
Water is a chemical is like saying, like, your mom is a woman, you know? Like, you're not considered, like, when you're like, I sleep with women, you want to exclude your mother from this.
Very true, very true. Sometimes very true, but...
Or don't exclude.
Yeah, I don't. But like I said before, CO2 is a chemical too, so is water. But these, the water vapor trails that we see that people think are chemtrails, these water vapor trails, those actually contribute a lot to the greenhouse effect as well. A bunch of undisturbed water vapor being distributed in the atmosphere, especially high up in the atmosphere where it doesn't dissipate very easily. That causes problems too. So here's a stunning fact. If you take a single flight, if you're a person who drives to work and does all this normal stuff you do, uses CO2 for everything from your consumer goods to your transportation to the whole nine yards, if you take a single consumer flight, it is responsible on average for 10% of your personal annual CO2 production, meaning that one flight makes up 10% of all of your CO2 production, including every day you drive to work, going out with friends, the CO2 it took to make your clothes, to do the to get you your food, all of that stuff. 10% of your impact is on that flight.
So what happens if you take more than 10 flights?
A lot.
You're over 100%.
Exactly, exactly. So you could drive a Prius all you want. You take 5 or 6 flights in a year, you've greatly increased your CO2 output.
Let's say I'm Radiohead, a band that is that actively tries to cut its carbon footprint.
Right.
So that means when I tour, do I go by barge? Do I just hitch a line, hitch a
like
ride
Like we
on
said,
a
bus. You got to go by bus. That's the way to do it.
Rowboat?
It would be funny if that's actually the reason John Madden always insists on driving everywhere by bus and not taking planes. He's just a super environmentalist.
Plus his weight on the plane adds a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
John Madden's looking out for his grandkids.
So that's been known for a long time. But now what this new study coming out is saying, which is interesting, and this is how I'm looping it back around, it indicates that rising temperatures due to climate change means that 10 to 30% of future commuter flights will have to start lightening their loads in order to take off in the hotter weather.
See, I don't understand that one.
So let me get into
it. Because planes, it's not like they're flying just at the limit of falling out of the sky.
No, this is takeoff and landing. So
yeah, but they're not right at the limit. So if it gets hotter a little bit, it's not like they're like, uh-oh, now we're not going to be able to take off.
No, it literally is. Runway. It literally is because it takes away. Now, you're right in the sense that it's not like they're pushing to the limit every point, but they are pushing to their preset limit, saying you can't take off at the exact edge because you're going to cause a possible problem, right? So you have these preset limits that are whatever percentage below that. Now they're hitting their own limits when they do this. And so if you're wondering, wait, why is the heat? Why would that have anything to do with it? Well, anything that's hot, it basically just means the molecules inside it are getting further and further apart. So you're exciting everything in there and it's less dense. Anything that's hot is, for the most part, less dense than its cooler counterparts. Less dense air, warmer air, means it's harder for that plane to take off. It takes more fuel, it takes more power to take off, and if it doesn't have the right power-to-weight ratio at that point, now that plane that could take off in 60, 70 degrees, it can't take off in 80 or 90 degrees. Now, it's not that that does not happen right now. That does. One of the reasons flights can get scrapped or they can have to delay until it cools down or lighten the load, take out some fuel, is because it's too hot. What they're saying is, based on the predictions that we're seeing and what is coming out of it, we think that as the future goes on, 10 to 30% of flights will have to be stopped as opposed to now, which is a much more nominal number.
What if we lined the runways with air conditioning units?
Oh, that'll work.
Like on either side, just pumping.
But we're going to have to get like a column of air, right? Because it still needs to take off, right? And keep going up. So then you're going to have like ladders with some AC units on it.
Like a ramp, but, yeah. But we take out the actual part that would launch the plane unless.
Someone like running behind the plane, blowing cold air at it. And then you're good.
With a leaf blower, like a, yeah. Like a team of Mexicans in the back of a pickup truck with leaf blowers.
Or just like a big banana tree branch.
Oh, going old school.
Banning it.
I mean, this is super interesting to me because I hadn't really conceptualized or even thought of the idea that, yeah, as it gets hotter, it's harder for planes to take off. And you might at some point get to a point where you either can't take that plane off or you have to wait for it to cool down or you have to lighten the load. And if you think about the fact that obviously planes contribute significantly to the greenhouse gas effect and thereby the rising of temperatures, the fact that they have been doing that for the past 50, 60 years is actually coming back to haunt them in that it's going to screw with their bottom line profit when they can't put certain planes in the air 10 to 30% of the time. Or our prices.
The prices will go up.
You know what? I'd argue, look at all the airlines that ended up going defunct or going out of business or getting into the red. It's not unreasonable that they're going to end up getting screwed over on that fiscally.
I think Boeing needs to design a new fucking plane, one that can defy the laws of physics and take off in any condition.
Couldn't they just put some like solar panels on top of the plane to counteract that?
So you want offset? Like, but they'd have to have like a hybrid plane at that point,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, a hybrid plane, and okay. Just that offset gets counteracted.
I like that. You know what? But actually,
although the batteries may be a little heavy,
some of the new planes come out do have some hybrid features to them, and they have some lithium batteries within them. So that actually might not be as crazy a thing as you might think.
Would a giant drone could that transport people? Like, if you designed a scale it big enough, would that be fuel efficient?
It doesn't matter. The idea is just that you can make a more fuel-efficient plane to take off from the ground. The point is that as temperatures get hotter, it's harder and harder for them to take off.
Even with that propeller design, the helicopter design, is it harder for...
Are you talking about like an Osprey?
Yeah, like the drones.
Yeah, no matter what, thinner air is going to equal harder time for that thing going up. And so that's always going to be a problem
for...
What
are the prospects on an electric plane? Like, are the batteries just too heavy, or is it possible?
I think the output to it, like, because batteries only store so much and electricity kind of takes that out really quickly. Unlike cars, where you can kind of regenerate your power by braking, you don't really have that option in the air. And so I don't know that you'd be able to fully charge it and do it. I mean, there are electric drones and stuff, like we've all seen those flying around. I've done a lot of work with those.
But they don't carry very much weight.
Not only do they not carry much weight, but they run out of power really quickly. So I've worked with those since like 2010, and the batteries have gotten significantly better since then. But even now, if you can get 10 to 15 minutes of flight time, you're running an expensive rig with a good battery.
What if those electric planes dragged a wind turbine behind it?
Oh, that won't slow it down at all.
You just make the whole fuselage is made of solar panels.
And it charges it up. Yeah. I'm just thinking of the energy per square inch that is provided by solar panels, and I just don't see that becoming a big one. But it is an interesting idea that these chemtrails really are real. They really are destroying the world. Those planes running around are causing significant damage to us. It's just not that they're filled with vats full of dangerous, poisonous chemicals. It's just that they're filled with fat Americans flying around.
So actually what you're saying is that cars emit mind-controlling substances.
Mind controlling,
because they're emitting the same gases. You're right, that's the whole thing.
But it's
with
not
the
mind controlling.
I thought that was the conspiracy with the chemtrails. That
yes,
there's mind controlling substances, and so you're saying actually it's the same thing as cars. So the cars too are controlling our minds.
Well, you've made some logical leaps there, Seb.
Think that's how deep this conspiracy is.
I got a question for you guys. It's a very interesting way to kind of think of the world and bring things back. Would this make you reconsider taking more flights? Now, if you had the option to drive somewhere or fly somewhere, would that change your mind?
No.
No, Damien?
Well, I'm poor, so the option to fly is like a really like a luxury.
And I would say even like most of the staunch environmentalists won't.
Interesting.
They won't give up their comfort and their for it.
See, I will say this. A lot of times I prefer driving. Like I used to travel back and forth.
But that's because you prefer driving.
Right. But I used to travel back and forth from the Bay Area, and it's a 50-minute flight from here. It's nothing, right? You get in real quick. And it's maybe a 7-plus-hour drive if you drive fast.
It's a nice drive, too.
Yeah. No, it's not.
If you go along the one.
Then it's a 10-hour drive.
Oh, yeah.
So the drive I would make is through a horrible Central Valley. It's not at all pretty.
Not nice at all.
Farts.
Yeah. But here is the things that I would suggest. And since I now consider this a public service based on this information, let me just put this forward to you guys. Again, 50-minute flight to 8-hour drive. Here was the difference for me. You got to show up to that airport a certain amount of time ahead of time. You have to have somebody drop you off, or you're parking your car someplace where you have to pay for it or whatever. You have to sit there with your luggage. You are contained to whatever luggage you can fit into that bag, and you're really not supposed to bring drugs. I mean, technically you can't, but we've all done it. So anyway, you're not supposed to bring drugs. And
that's why we have an anus.
Yeah, that's right. Then you got to sit in the security line. You got to go through. You have to have some asshole yell at you who has a minimum wage job and way too much power. You have to have that guy yell at you. Then you have to get on this plane, sandwich yourself next to some horrible, horrible human being. Go take your flight over to wherever you're going. Maybe get bumped from fog, which happens a lot when you're going to the Bay Area. Finally get off and then somehow get a ride from the airport to your place. After all of that is said and done, a 50-minute flight, if you including prep time and wait time and the whole nine yards and the buffer you have to put in, can easily be like 5 hours. You know, like if you have to think, you have to get there an hour ahead of time.
I think it's 5 hours if like everything goes wrong.
No, it's
other than the flight being
trust
canceled.
Me, it's taken me 10 hours when everything's gone wrong because you get diverted to a different airport or the cab that you're supposed to get in isn't there. It's been much worse than that. But I just mean in terms of, you have to pack everything really carefully. You have to get there an hour early. Then you have to go through line. You have to give yourself a buffer so you're there early plus enough time to go through the line. You have to arrange your transportation, which is always going to be slower than if you were just driving directly there or back.
Pardon me, sir or ma'am, but how much do you pack when just going up?
How long does it take you to go to the airport?
They're reasonable.
It takes me like half an hour max to get there, and then I'm there an hour ahead of my flight.
You are a heterosexual man. Right. There's no reason you should be packing that much.
I told you, I got to get tied those drugs.
And it's like things can go wrong on your drive up there, too. What if your car breaks down? What if there's traffic? You know, there's a lot of all these extenuating circumstances.
I planned around that.
You planned around breaking down.
Yes. I keep my vehicles in good shape, Seb. I can make that drive. I can pretty much gauge when it's going to be. If I go at night, which I like to do, it's going to be comfortable. The roads are going to be clear. There's not going to be any traffic. I know exactly what I need to stop for gas, and I can bring as much shit as I want, as I can fit into my car, including if I fit three or four people in there. Now my price to do this has gone so drastically down that it's really cheap, Plus, it's more convenient. Now I'm wherever I am. I have my vehicle with me, so I'm not stuck in a different city without my vehicle.
Well, that's the point. It's just out of convenience. You're not doing that because you're trying to save the planet.
Right. Not only convenience, but at the time also pragmatically for cost, because it's cheaper to do it that way. I am saying this. I'm not saying, look at me, I'm a martyr, you guys should do it my way. What I'm saying is, here are some benefits you might not have thought of. Given this new information, which is another thing to consider, you might consider making drives on certain things that are 500, 600 mile flights if you have the option.
But I think people do that.
Maybe.
People consider driving.
Good. Here is one more thing. Consider it once more, because that one flight, if that's the only flight you take, will occupy 10% of your CO2 output
for the
year.
No, that was the cross-country flights you said.
Oh, here's the other
thing. So if you're driving cross-country, that's like a four-day drive.
I'm sorry, I forgot to add this too. The longer the flight, the more efficient it is, because you use most of the fuel to get up and come down. So the shorter flights are the least efficient ones. So actually, if you're going around the world, that's the most efficient way to fly in
a
plane.
Yeah, but you're still using
more. So if you're doing
more.
These short little hopper flights, that's actually the worst type of flight.
What
per
is,
hour. Yes.
What is the CO2 impact, just the environmental impact, of hot air ballooning?
You know, that's actually a really good question. I don't know, Damien. I would imagine you got to make a lot of hot air, so.
Yeah, most of it's just wine bottles being littered from off.
Actually, it turns out it's entirely due to that.
Wine bottles scattered across flyover country. A kid was killed the other day.
All right, guys, I'm not going to tease you any longer. We're going to go right into it. Let's discuss this great flat Earth debate we went to this week. Damien, we had set this debate up with a guy. I want to preface this. A lot of people might say, hey, man, you're not supposed to debate these people. Like, you're not supposed to debate creationists. It gives credence to what they're doing. I just want to give my disclaimer out there. I am usually on your side with that argument. In fact, I did not start this debate, nor did I even want to be necessarily part of it when this first started. I was asked by somebody else to do it, and the reason I accepted was twofold. One of which is, the person who was making these flat earth arguments is very prolific and very aggressive with these arguments. He's not sitting there believing his stuff on his own. He goes out to other people's Facebook walls. He goes out to public forums and he posts about it. And in this particular case, somebody, a comedian, cracked a joke about something about the flat earth. And he posted on it. Now, I'm not saying he posted once or posted twice or posted his ideas three times. He actually, before I even got involved in this post, before I was asked to come and debate him, he posted 40 times on a single guy's wall post.
A lot of them memes. And if you guys know the people who post a lot of memes, they all share some qualities, some antisocial qualities.
Right.
So just let that pepper your vision.
So I took that into account. And then also I looked at the thread. I looked at the Facebook message thread that all of this started on. And I noticed that one person had an interesting comment that I think is indicative of why we do occasionally have to confront them. And it was one person basically saying, hey, you know, I don't really know about all this stuff, but he is making some interesting arguments. So I kind of feel like at some point you have to get out there and state the facts. You have to argue about what's actually going on. And you can't just sit there and say, we're not going to participate because it's beneath
us. Yeah, I don't agree with the no platforming
And
strategy.
I think there's some element to it where you're like, okay, we've debated creationists 1,000 times. We don't need to talk to Ken Ham again. It's just going to be the same thing over and over again. But if nobody's saying it, then we're not putting out the side of truth. And somebody does have to stick up. And the other thing that people were saying is, hey, this guy sounds a little nutty. This guy sounds a little crazy. Maybe, but he is also a very prolific video maker. He's also a very prolific internet personality. He also does this a lot. This is a huge thing. He goes on radio shows. He talks about this. So whether you think he's crazy or not, one is, I'm not here to diagnose him. I'm not a psychiatrist. And if I was, I would know that it's unethical to diagnose somebody you haven't had a session with. So I'm not here to decide he's crazy or he's not crazy. I'm here to debate his ideas. And quite frankly, let's say he is crazy. Let's say he's the craziest guy in the world. It's still an ad hominem attack to say we're not going to discuss your ideas because you're crazy. The craziest person in the world can still say 2 + 2 = 4 and be right. We need to attack bad ideas that are had by anybody if they're being promoted through the broader general public.
He's not Steve Nash. He's not like a crazy guy we need to listen to. Yes. Steve Nash is the one crazy guy.
Basketball player?
Yes. The Canadian basketball player who proved...
I'll be damned if a 6'1" white guy's be getting MVP of the league twice in a row.
Not all about him.
You mean John Nash?
John Nash. There you go. I stand by Steve Nash, too, because a lot of his papers were dismissed because he just happened to be an NBA player.
we're going to be releasing again. The entire debate will be audio released on my other podcast, The Degenerates, in a week or so. And the entire video debate will be released via our website at www.thesciencefaction.com in about a week and a half. So a little bit after that. Though I will say, if you want to know exactly when it comes out, go ahead and subscribe to the Science Faction Facebook page, and we will make a notation as soon as that happens so you can go check it out right away. But I do want to give you guys a couple of clips. So this first one is going to give you an idea of a flaw that Daniel finds in our particular viewpoints of a global Earth. I must say, I did prepare very stringently for this debate. I had not prepared for this particular argument. That was my fault. I was being short-sighted. So this is the first time Seb will hear this. Seb hasn't heard this before. Let's go ahead and listen to a little clip from me debating Daniel at the Flat Earth debate.
But then how would you explain...
How many satellites are up in space, Robert?
Millions, probably, by now. At least tens of thousands.
Millions, huh? Well, that's more than...
I mean, if you're talking about artificial ones, tens of thousands, easily.
So why can't one of these satellites take a picture of the buildings... on the bottom of the Earth, hanging upside down.
They don't hang upside down.
Wait, they don't?
They don't hang upside down any more than we do here.
Wait a minute. So these buildings aren't... There's buildings going up here.
Right, go ahead and take that with you.
There's buildings up here. And
right.
There's buildings down here.
Then. Right.
There's people... People and buildings and also helicopters and airplanes.
Yes.
And
they're all attracted by gravity towards the center of the Earth.
Hot weather balloons, they're all flying upside down.
They're flying right side up relative to themselves. They're all in being attracted by gravity to the center of the Earth.
Well, that's not what you just said. What are you talking about, dude? You just totally...
I mean, I think it's pretty simple. So there's gravity...
So buildings aren't hanging... What's going on in your model, then? Where are they?
They're on the surface of the Earth. Pick any place on Earth. San Diego is the same as Lebanon, is the same as Nigeria. All of these places have gravity pulling them towards the ground.
I'm confused.
Clearly.
In the heliocentric model, the buildings in the northern hemisphere are pointing up and the buildings in the southern hemisphere are pointing down because there's people hanging upside down.
So I think
you might
have been confused with what up and down means.
You're talking about relativity, then it doesn't exist because up is down and down is up and east is west and west is east.
Well, what is your definition?
That was one of those interesting ones because I got to tell you, I prepared super deeply for this debate. I went real deep into the flat Earth world. And those of you who think, these are just crackpots, you know, they kind of are. But there is a huge mythos surrounding this. There is a lot of background stuff that they've got. There's a lot of ideas that they put into this stuff. So in order to argue them, you have to go real deep into their world. And I got to tell you, that was something I was not expecting.
Well, the thing is, there is evidence the Earth is flat. There's just more evidence that it's round, and all that evidence explains the flat evidence.
So just like any other model, you want something that explains everything you see or explains most of the stuff you see. So if you were to say, hey, look, I don't see any curvature of the Earth. Well, that's true, but we wouldn't expect to see it from this ground level, except when the ship goes over the horizon and we see the crow's nest is the last thing we see, in which case we are seeing curvature of the Earth in an indirect sense, or we see the sun setting over the Earth.
Or if you're far enough away that you can actually see that it's curved.
But you have to be at past 40,000 feet, which is higher than commercial. Airlines do, and so it becomes one of those conundrums.
People being upside down in Australia would explain why Australians are so prone to migraines.
That's
true. Just all that lifestyle
blood rushing to their head.
that is absolutely true. Obviously, we had some weird conflicting things like that. That was one of those weird things that I was not expecting. There was some that I was able to actually get him to admit, like, we don't have an answer for this. I guess you're right. I'm going to have to go look into this. One of them being, like, because he doesn't believe that satellites are real, though he does go back and forth. He does think
Phones and...
Well, phones...
I mean, not all phones.
No,
but
phones are done by...
But there's
by,
definitely...
By
or
ground,
or like satellite dishes and...
Right, okay, so the two were GPS and satellite dishes. He believes GPS works with a ground-based system. He goes over that in his scenario, and I go, okay, theoretically, what you're saying could work if you had line of sight to one of these stations that you imagine are hidden around on the ground at all times. It could theoretically work, except for one thing, which is, even if I give you that, let's say these things are everywhere, they're every place you get GPS, and I've done GPS up in the mountains and obscure places out in the desert where there's certainly no transmitters, but let's say they're hidden, I don't see it, fine. How does it account for altitude? because that triangulation would not be able to tell you your altitude. If you imagine those things, let's say on mountaintops or whatever, triangulating, they could tell you your relative distance from one another, but you could be 100 feet below them or 100 feet above them and you'd be getting the same reading because that's the same distance. The way it works on GPS satellites is the satellites are always above you. You're getting a direct line back. You can only be at one altitude and one location longitude and latitude wise. Didn't answer that, but he kept going, and so I brought up a DirecTV installer. I showed him a picture of a guy putting up DirecTV.
They're all part of the conspiracy.
Right? No, he actually specifically said they're not. They're just doing their job, and I explained to him these guys hook into a geosynchronous satellite, which is an information satellite. It stays around at the exact same point in Earth, by the way, unlike GPS satellites, but it stays geosynchronous along the equator. That's why if you're in the northern hemisphere and you walk around looking, those dishes are always pointed somewhere towards the south, depending on what specific satellite they're pointed at. Could be southeast, could be southwest. But they're always pointed somewhere towards the south in the northern hemisphere.
He made a big deal about that 45-degree angle.
Right, because he didn't understand. He's like, why wouldn't they just point anywhere up? And I was like, and I had to explain, no, Daniel, these geosynchronous satellites have to be around the equator. That's the only way they work. And then we got into it, and I explained to, and he was trying to tell me how those satellites don't exist. And I asked him, well, then how come when that guy moves that satellite dish an inch one way or an inch another way, so it's no longer pointing at that geosynchronous satellite, you lose signal? Eventually, he had to admit he couldn't answer that question. It was a flaw in the flat Earth model, and he would have to go back and research it to figure out what the solution to that flaw was. So that was good. We got one through at least. I think we had a few of those moments.
Just, I mean, all he needs to do is just cite an insane YouTube video that he himself could have made, and that's his research.
The other big one that I had, which I believe strongly in, and I think is really the one that it clinches it, and there's just no other way to explain it, is the model of the stars as they spin. So I'll just go over this briefly because you can go and check the actual clip out later. But if you can imagine being anywhere in the northern hemisphere, if you look towards the north, you can sit with either a time-lapse camera or just lay for a long period of time on your back and watch as the stars spin around the North Star. And if you have a time-lapse camera, it'll look like a bunch of streaks, a bunch of circles going around in the sky around the North Star. Now, that works on the flat Earth model, too, because in the flat Earth model, everything is spinning around in this big dome over the North Pole. So that technically works in the same way.
In the flat Earth, the stars are spinning around us,
yes,
or the disk is spinning?
No. Disk is stationary.
Okay.
Are we the center of the disk, or are we the way on the outside?
No, the North Pole is center of the disk.
The disk doesn't spin, but it's accelerated up, right?
No.
Isn't that how they explain gravity?
No. We talked about gravity, too. There is no gravity. It's just,
density
and buoyancy. That was an interesting conversation as well. But then you have to think of what it would look like from the southern hemisphere looking south. So think of a flat Earth model. You're looking south. If the Earth is actually a flat plane with the North Pole being the very center of it, anything, you're in Chile, you're in Argentina, you're in Australia, you're looking south. You're looking at this big ice wall that rings this entire flat plate planet. So if the stars are in a dome spinning around you, imagine what you would see looking south. You would see the equivalent of standing on like a carousel in this very center. Imagine a carousel that had a center part that didn't spin, like the center was mounted to the ground, and you're standing there and you're not spinning, but the carousel is spinning around you. Think of the horses on the exterior of that as the stars. You would essentially see almost like an old-timey animation of the stars going around you. But what you actually see in the southern hemisphere when you look south is exactly what you see in the northern hemisphere when you look north, which is a bunch of stars all making circles around a single point.
But this
there's no way to explain that in the flat Earth model.
But doesn't he not think Antarctica exists?
Right.
No, but he thinks it's like a wall of ice around the whole...
Yeah.
But there's no southern hemisphere in the flat Earth model.
But you can make the argument when you're in Chile, wherever you are.
No.
You are looking south. What is making this?
You should see the same thing as it when you're in the north.
On the globe Earth, you should. On the flat Earth, you should not.
No. I mean, not like the analogous thing. I mean, you would literally see the same stars moving the same way no matter where you are on the planet.
Their argument is that you can't see that far, that there's a certain distance you can't see light up to, which is also, of course, a BS argument, but it's consistent with their own universe.
But so he's saying, let's say you're like in North America and you can see the North Star.
Right.
But then you move to Chile. You've now moved
too far away. Yes. Which is the same way they explain sunsets.
That would mean that if you were to move from North America to Chile, you would see the stars slowly like dim away and disappear.
Except, you can make the same argument of a sunset. Sunset, you can watch that sun fall behind the horizon. They're saying it's going past a vanishing point. And it's like, I've never seen anything. Whenever I see something go far away from me, it gets smaller and smaller and smaller and disappears. Half of it doesn't suddenly go away.
Wait, in their model, the sun goes like It doesn't go around the disk.
Oh, no, no.
You couldn't explain it.
It goes circular.
Yes, absolutely. But regardless, the star thing, one of the problems with this type of debate is you have to find what doesn't work in their own models. You can't just go, hey, this doesn't work because of this, this, and this, because if it's consistent within their own models, then it doesn't matter if it doesn't work in reality. So you have to find the flaws in their models. In their own flat Earth models, the stars would not look the way they do in the Southern Hemisphere. So his only retort to that was that he does not believe pictures are real. And so that was a problem.
For a guy also, who loves memes so much.
I don't understand this. He had a rule, no visual evidence. There's only five kinds of evidence. Visual, auditory, smell, taste, and feeling.
And sexual.
Is that just specifically come? Like, oh, we got sexual evidence all over this court.
If it's not visual evidence.
It's also one of the only kinds of healing.
He wants to smell that the earth is round or flat?
Yeah.
I don't understand.
And by the way, I also pointed out that you can actually take a consumer flight. It's not even that expensive. Over Antarctica, they do a sightseeing tour that leaves Qantas does from Australia over Antarctica. He didn't like that either. But regardless, very interesting debate. I want to hear one more clip, at least on this episode, one more clip before we go of Daniel. And this will be him bringing up something that's actually something I learned in researching this debate, something that I learned about the real world that I wasn't necessarily as aware of. I did not know. I had some kind of inkling to some extent, but I did not know it was to this extreme until I started researching stuff for the Flat Earth. This is where I actually discovered something very interesting about science and the history of science based on learning about Flat Earth and the Flat Earth ideas.
What keeps the water in?
Well, it's obviously, there's pictures of the ice wall.
There's an ice wall.
Yeah, there's a 200 to 1,000 foot ice wall that's surrounding us, and that's the Antarctic shelves. You can just go look it up. It's very simple. It's 2017, people. You have phones in your pocket. Please, please, please.
So the stars and the sun and the planets, these are what you call luminaries. These are just lights moving through the stone?
Those are luminaries. The sun and the moon are obviously the most. It's the yin-yang symbol. The Chinese had the model correctly. If you look at the yin-yang symbol, it's literally the sun and the moon spiraling around one another, and that's why we go, oh, those damn Chinese are so stupid. Those Chinese astronomers...
I don't know if I've ever heard anyone say that.
Those damn Chinese astronomers don't know what the hell they're talking about. They think their world's flat. Oh, by the way, every single culture that ever existed in the history of the Earth thought the Earth was flat until recently. Until NASA took pictures of a ball that you can't see from your own vantage point.
Well, that's funny that you say that, because when I was going into this Flat Earth debate and doing the research, I actually had that kind of assumption myself too, that ancient cultures thought the Earth was flat, but in reality they didn't. In fact, a long time ago they figured out not only was the Earth spherical, but they were able to actually calculate how big the Earth was. There's a famous Greek experiment looking at the shadows that are cast differently based on your north and south positioning, and measuring when the shadows go directly down a deep well, and therefore the sun is directly overhead, and then when the sun casts a shadow. And with that information alone, they were able to calculate the circumference of the Earth rather accurately. Now, almost all these seafaring cultures knew, or at least assumed, that the world was spherical in one way or another. And the reason was very simple. When they would watch something go out to sea, they would see the boat disappear bottom first. And the last thing you see is the crow's nest, the last part of the top of the ship going out. So in fact, when we have this idea that ancient cultures thought the world was flat, they really didn't. The Greeks calculated their navigation based on a spherical Earth. Navigation going back literally 2,000 years goes back to a spherical Earth. A sextant uses a spherical Earth, and in fact, the flat Earth idea didn't really come around into the mainstream until the 1800s, where it was brought up because of biblical literalism, because there are parts of the Bible that talk about the four corners of a plain Earth, and because of that, the idea of a flat Earth became much more common in the 1800s. So when we think of this as people back then thought this way, they really didn't. And we have a lot of evidence to support that they didn't think that way.
So anyway, if nothing comes out of this debate, if nothing comes out of refuting those ideas, if nothing else, I will at least say this. I did gain a better appreciation for the actual history of these ideas, because we do sometimes think of previous people as maybe being dumber or simpler than we gave them credit for. And I will say this. I knew that the Greeks had calculated the circumference of the Earth. I knew that. And I knew, you know, stuff about certain ancient calendars. But I still thought, the majority of people probably still thought this. They really didn't. And that kind of a whole movement, that whole flat Earth movement, that whole flat Earth idea, it came about in the 1800s. That's a really interesting thing to realize.
What if, oddly enough, most flat earthers are Chinese? And then maybe the thought of his super racist, oh, those damn dumb Chinese, in there, was in fact true.
Maybe he's actually the best person to promote global Earth ideas, because he's going to say that. Then all those flat Earth Chinese people are going to be like, screw that guy and his idiot ideas.
Where has he heard this idea that Chinese people are stupid?
I don't know.
They have a reputation of being like the most advanced society through all of history.
That's an interesting dude. It was an interesting debate. Again, if you want to hear the full debate next week, the Degenerates podcast, the entire thing will just be that debate. And then about a week after that, we will be releasing the full video on our website, www.thesciencefaction.com. Subscribe to our Facebook page to get a notification when that comes up. So check out the Degenerates podcast page for that, or our website later on. But for now, let's move right on to I Call BS.
I call.
Ring, ring.
I call BS.
So wait, you're on another podcast?
Yes, I.
You're on two podcasts.
For years.
This has been going on under my nose for years. Well,
that's a big no. So.
Color me betrayed.
Yeah. All right.
A lot of spots to hide.
All right. I call BS, of course, the game where I read 4 science news articles and my panelists compete to see which ones are real and which ones are BS, standing for bad science. Are you guys ready to play?
Yes, I'm ready to play. I'm also ready to commit to just one podcast. But yeah. I mean, what do I know?
Okay. Well, you should start committing sometime soon. All right. Article number one.
Is the other podcast for you, or they referred to as Yoko?
Yeah, that's right. They're breaking up this podcast.
Article number one. Researchers have found a short video that, when stared at, gives the viewer an almost superpower-like ability to read tiny letters that they otherwise couldn't see. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is science. It's actually just any movie starring a small character, like the Burrowers or something. Even though they appear regular size on TV, it just gets the mind in that small mindset.
Once you start seeing a small creature in a larger version, then everything gets bigger.
Yeah. Watch Fievel Goes West to tell me that you can't pass the eye chart at the DMV.
Congratulations. You just became the stupidest person I've debated with this week. All right, and Seb.
I think this is science, because I'm pretty sure the video is just really small naked people. So then people concentrate really hard on seeing something small, and then they look at the letters.
You know what, Seb?
That.
I actually like that idea. It was like an idea I had for a long time ago, where I was like, screw this Rosetta Stone program and all these other language learning things. Just start showing young boys porn from other countries. They will learn that language so fast. All right.
Fortunately, their vocabulary may not be socially appropriate.
But if they ever want to be a pizza boy or a cable repairman.
Wow, the way he says, come on my tits, was just impeccable.
Were you born here? Article number two. The Australian Prime Minister has declared that the laws of Australia supersede the laws of mathematics. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is science, and if you don't agree, we'll Steve Irwin you.
They'll just send a stingray after you?
Australia has a famous stingray hit squad that it's world renowned. Have you not heard of this?
It's like MI5, but they just stab you in the chest with a stingray and run away.
Crikey.
All right, and Seb.
I wouldn't put anything past an Australian Prime Minister. Not because he's Australian, but because he's a Prime Minister. So
hate the parliamentary system.
Article number three. Even if all the other animals on Earth die, scientists believe that the last living creature will probably be the ultimate survivor, the cockroach, and that it will live until the sun dies and destroys the Earth. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is bad science. It will be the creature the cockroach evolves into, the humanoid creature that the cockroach grows into.
So like a cockroach mixed with Jeff Goldblum is what you're saying. They got into a teleporter.
Yes, like Jeff Goldblum did a movie called The Roach.
Fair enough. And Seb?
I mean, they always say, like, the thing that survives in a nuclear bomb is a cockroach or something like that. So.
Couldn't rats.
But I think it's just by numbers, you know.
There are a lot of them.
It's just, like, there's so many of them that statistically, even if a tiny percent survive, that's still a lot of cockroaches.
Wouldn't the same thing apply to rats? Like, wouldn't rats inherit the earth by that same?
But I think there's more cockroaches than rats.
But rats are, like, intelligent and can prey on them.
Yeah, but you just need, like, almost everything dies, and you need a tiny percent that survive. And so with rats, you need a higher percentage to survive to still have the same number as cockroaches.
So, Seb, I need a final answer.
I think it's science.
All right. Article number 4. The largest iceberg in historical record has broken off of Antarctica, resulting in a chunk of ice 4 times the size of London falling into the ocean. Damien's a science or bad science?
This is science, and it's also bad news, because now there's a huge hole in the seawall, and White Walkers are going to start flooding in any fucking second.
I will say this. This might be a little bit more of a debate teaser. At one point, he did, when asked why they would be making this big conspiracy and keeping people from accessing the giant seawall, he speculated that there would be land and other peoples beyond it. So they would be White Walkers, but technically beyond the ice wall. It's the end of ours, but then who knows?
Actually, if Antarctica melts, it's a big problem for those guys, because they think now all the water is going to fall off the disc.
What if that's where all the other hominids were? Maybe some ant advanced species said, nope, we can't mix the hominids. Get the Australopithecus in this petri dish and the ones with the big dongs in this one.
All right. And Seb.
I think I know what story you're talking about, and I think the problem is the size of the iceberg. I think London was too small. I thought it was like the size of a state or something. So I think it's bad science.
All right. Seb says bad science. Let's go back and see how you guys did. Follow along at home and see how you did. Article number 1. Researchers have found a short video that, when stared at, gives the viewer an almost superpower-like ability to read tiny letters that they otherwise could not see. Both of you guys thought this one was science, and this one is science. Very interesting. It's actually a spiral pattern. It's kind of like one of those old-timey hypnotist patterns. You can go on our website, check it out. It will be posted up there. You can play this video, and you might ask, how did they do this experiment? Well, they had people stare at this particular video, as well as other ones for controls, for about 30 seconds. Before they had you do that, they had you read one of those like DMV eye charts and see how far down you could go. You'd stare at this thing for 30 seconds and then read again, and you could go further down. You could read further down on the eye chart to a significant amount. So it makes you think, like, oh, what's going on? How does this work? Well, one of the clues is this spiral going one way makes you be able to read better. The other way, it does not. And so one of the ideas that they're thinking is it actually impacts the way your vision is processing this language, this data. One of the things I'd like to see is if it changes based on whether you're reading right to left or left to right.
I was about to ask that.
Yeah, and that'll take further studies. But one of the ideas is when you see that stuff jumbled together in those tiny little letters, part of it is they're very small. But you're still making out some bases of it. You can still probably take in some visual information, but your brain isn't able to separate the letters enough for you to distinguish what is what in there. However, this particular thing, because of that winding style, is making your eyes kind of adjust to floating and separating things out, and therefore you might be able to have some better visual acuity by separating out the individual letters.
So it fluffs your reading boner.
That's exactly right. That's how they put it in the article. This is a short effect. It only lasts for a few minutes, so it's not long term, but great idea. If you are, go download this thing on your phone. If you have to go to the DMV and your eyesight is failing you, sit there right before the test just staring at this thing nonstop, and then go up there and you will do better on your eye test. All right. Article number 2. The Australian Prime Minister has declared that the laws of Australia supersede the laws of mathematics. Both of you guys thought this one was science, and this one is science. Very interesting comment over a recent political debate about cybersecurity encryption. Spokespeople for the government have said that their laws will allow security agencies to check in on suspected terrorists and child abusers, but the details of the laws have yet to be fully revealed. But the people looking at the legislation, like the critics of this legislation, they argue that what the government is asking for is impossible. They're basically asking for certain de-encryption and encryption abilities that aren't mathematically impossible given the current framework of how we do encryption.
The quantum computer salesman said so.
So when the prime minister was challenged by a reporter as to whether what he was proposing conflicted with the laws of mathematics, the prime minister responded with, "The laws of Australia prevail in Australia. I can assure you of that. The laws of mathematics are very commendable, but the only law that applies in Australia are the laws of Australia."
Well, at least he's confident.
Yeah, right?
He lives right next to the seawall. He can see it.
I feel like our president's attitude is spreading through the world. Like, yeah, the laws of mathematics are good, I guess, but they're nothing like our laws. Our laws are number one.
Well, didn't they have Abbott before? I thought Australia already had a Trump character. He's just fucking Australia. He's not the current guy.
Right.
He might be the current guy.
Sounds
it's
like
just
they got
hard
a new one.
To tell because they've got their accent. You can't really tell which ones are their Trump characters or which one are the smart ones.
Yeah, they're all just white guys with funny accents who are slaughtering indigenous people. All right,
one wallaby.
Yeah. Article number 3. Even if all the other animals on Earth die, scientists believe that the last living creature will probably be the ultimate survivor, the cockroach, and that it will live until the sun dies and destroys the Earth. Damien thinks this is false. Seb thinks this is true. And this one is bad science. All of that was true. They do think there will be a last living creature on Earth. They think it will live literally up until the moment that the sun destroys the Earth. But it will not be the cockroach. The cockroach actually has some more complex demands, including food and atmosphere, that will make it much more difficult, as opposed to what they do believe will be the last survivor of Earth, the tardigrade. We've discussed it before, the little water bear, or as Damien has named him, the tardy bear.
He's always late everywhere.
We've talked about them a whole bunch. They're one of the most resilient forms of life on Earth. They're able to survive for 30 years without food or water and endure.
But are there a lot of them? Around?
Oh, yes. They're everywhere. Okay. So they're basically microscopic, and they're everywhere.
They're omnipresent. Anywhere you go, they're...
they can go 30 years without food or water. They can endure temperatures up to 150 degrees Celsius and the deep sea, and even in the frozen vacuums of space. So they've been able to be sent out to space in an open vacuum, come back, and still be alive.
So they could be like the biological creature that brought life to Earth.
Right. So we know they evolved here because we can see their evolutionary history, but they might be the one that we shoot off into space to bring Earth life elsewhere. The animal can live up to 60 years and grow to a maximum of half a millimeter. It's best seen under a microscope. Those, when they're really big, you can just barely see them with just your eyes. They will definitely outlive us all and likely outlive maybe even our planet if we shoot them off in the right directions in space.
What if I stop drinking? Would it outlive me then?
Still going to outlive you, yes. Oh. All right.
Well, then why stop?
And article number 4, the largest iceberg in historical record has broken off Antarctica, resulting in a chunk of ice 4 times the size of London falling into the ocean. Damien thinks this is true. Seb thinks it's false. And this one is bad science. Indeed, a giant iceberg 4 times the size of London did break off as part of the Larsen Sea ice sheet and went into the ocean. It's a horrible thing, and it's a bad harbinger of things to come. But it is not indeed the biggest on record.
Oh, that was the catch.
The section of the ice sheet is roughly 6,000 kilometers squared, but it is not the biggest one. It was known as B-15, and it was a huge chunk off the Ross ice sheet that broke off in 2000, measuring about 11,000 square kilometers. So that one was substantially bigger than this one currently, almost double the size. Though this is still really bad. It's a bad harbinger because once we start... first of all, if you're a ship's captain out there, be wary. There's some large-ass pieces of ice floating around. Number two, obviously, as the planet warms up, we're in for a lot of other problems surrounding that. But this was not the largest one, meaning that, of course, Seb is this week's winner. Congratulations, Seb, for, again, every single time just coming in and beating the shit out of Damien.
It was a fucking tie. And you say, like, every
week... Tie goes to scientist, Damien. It's like you forget this every week. It's so weird that you keep forgetting
no,
this.
No.
It's probably why you keep losing.
No. I don't forget it. I just don't forget that it's a fucking injustice.
It doesn't seem like an injustice at all. It's just like in baseball where the tie goes to the runner.
Well, at least you're not claiming I never win, ironically, against the scientist who I win against the most.
I mean, I've never seen you win. Perhaps you play this game at home later on after doing it here and then listen at home like some of our audience members do, play there and then possibly you win. Or maybe you're talking about the fact that, you know, we do have audience members, a lot of audience members, they tell us a lot about how they play along at home, they enjoy the game. Maybe you're saying occasionally some of them actually lose to you by getting more answers right, and therefore you're winning against some abstract group of people who are out there listening to this podcast later on.
I enjoy your Falkenbach-esque explanation, but you're the flat earther of denying me victory on this show.
Speaking of victory on the show, thank you so much, Seb, for coming out and playing.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, audience, for coming out for 183, where you learned about the great flat earth debate. Why the CO2 from planes are causing them to not be able to take off in the future. How a short video can improve your eyesight. Why the Australian Prime Minister thinks Australian laws supersede the laws of mathematics. Why the tardy bear is going to outlive us all. And why a huge chunk of ice just broke off of Antarctica. Thank you so much for listening, and come on back next week for Science Faction 184.
Up is down and down is up, and east is west and west is east. And
what is your definition?
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.